You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When Secretary of the Treasury Timothy Geithner called him on New Year's Eve 2009 and asked him to lead a restructuring of the auto industry, it was a kind of challenge Stephen Ratner didn't think twice about accepting. Now he's written a book about the Obama administration and the largest corporate restructuring in American history. It's called Overhaul, an insider's account of the Obama administration's emergency rescue of the auto industry. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, and I'm very pleased to bring Stephen Ratner to our show today. Hello.
Hello, and thanks so much for having me.
When it was announced that you were going to lead the auto bailout, some critics felt that your experience as a reporter for the New York Times, even your career on Wall Street with Lehman and the Quadrangle Group, the private investment firm that you helped found, wasn't exactly a background best suited for arranging an overhaul of the auto industry. Had you had any experience in autos or manufacturing?
Virtually none. I was certainly not an auto guy. I wasn't really a manufacturing guy. I had spent almost all of my career on Wall Street working with media and telecommunications companies. I don't think they minded that. I don't think they minded that I was a New York Times reporter, but I think they thought there was a missing piece.
Were you surprised that they'd even considered you?
I was not as surprised that they considered me as I was by this outcry against me. And Tim Geithner and Larry Summers, who hired me, were also surprised. None of us really, frankly, anticipated it. They saw the job very clearly as a restructuring job, not a running of an auto company job. And so they thought my experience was very much on point. And so we had to push back against that.
Well, you probably knew as much about the auto industry as Robert Nardelli of Chrysler did when he became the head of that company.
No, I think he knew more. He had certainly worked in manufacturing. But the basic point is, again, you didn't really have to know anything about the auto industry. This was a financial restructuring exercise. And frankly, given Detroit's failure to come to grips with its problems, given its insular culture, I think in retrospect, all of us felt that having a team that came from outside the auto industry was actually a plus.
And then you write that the vetting process to get the post cost you $400,000 in legal fees. Why was it so expensive? If that's the norm, I'd imagine no one from the private sector would ever take a job in government.
Very few people from the private sector have lately, either because of this kind of a thing. I wouldn't suggest that my experience was absolutely average. My finances are a little more complicated. But the fact is that while I was in Washington and since, there were many, many people from the private sector who couldn't even get past the first step because of some past affiliation or some past holding that, frankly, I think is irrelevant, but was deemed disqualifying by the minders.
So often some nanny that you had 10, 20 years before.
It's worse than that. There were people who literally couldn't serve because they had taken some modest home office deduction and not counted their square feet exactly right and owed $300 of extra tax. The stories are really mind-boggling.
Well, was the vetting process in your case complicated because of your involvement in the New York State Attorney General's investigation into the pay-to-play pension fund scandal that recently got Alan Hevesy sent to prison?
No, that actually had nothing to do with my vetting. My involvement in it was fully disclosed to the people who hired me, and at that point in time, it was not a problem. Nobody thought it was a problem, including the New York State Attorney General, and that only came up later. So no, it was related really to simply untangling my finances and getting them in a form where the government said I didn't have a financial conflict of interest.
And you didn't sense any hard feelings from President Obama and the team because you'd been a major supporter of Hillary Clinton's campaign?
Virtually everybody, I shouldn't say virtually everybody, but many, many people in the Obama administration were either supporters of Hillary Clinton's campaign or served in President Clinton's administration, not the least of whom was Hillary Clinton herself, of course, at the State Department. So no, I think that I wasn't particularly close to President Obama, and I think certainly having a better relationship, a deeper relationship, is always helpful. It would have been different if Hillary Clinton had been president in terms of my relationship with her. But there were many, many people brought in who also didn't have a particularly long-standing relationship with President Obama, but were picked for their skills.
Well, let's talk about the situation that you were getting involved with. It was felt that the CEOs of the big three automakers made a serious miscalculation when In November 2008, they flew to Washington in their private jets to testify before Congress. Were you surprised by how tone-deaf all three of those CEOs appeared to be?
Sure. I remember being struck by it at the time and thinking to myself, you know, if they had just taken one private jet and shared it, maybe none of this would have happened. As I write,
you could have flown first class.
Well, that they would have viewed as a big step down. But one of the things I didn't know until I did the research for the book was that, in fact, GM's PR person in Washington said to Rick Wagoner, "Don't take the plane." And Rick said, "I'm a busy man. I don't have a lot of time to waste. I need to." And, of course, the consequence was that when he went back in December, he had to drive to Washington to show his loyalty to the automobile culture, and that wasted even more of his time.
But all three of them, not just Rick Wagoner of GM, Alan Mulally of Ford, Robert Nardelli of Chrysler, they all, I guess that was just the way they thought. And it did lead to a major backlash against the big three.
It was huge. And I would only say in fairness to them that it's the way they traveled. It's part of the corporate culture in America. They, I don't think, thought much about it. And it had never really been an issue until then.
Now, before you took office in February 2009, the Bush administration had already begun the process of bailing out GM and Chrysler. So was it your job to continue that process or to rethink everything?
A little bit of both. The Bush administration, it was at the very end of 08 that this happened, as you pointed out. It was the administration had a lot on its plate. It was tired. It didn't have a lot of political capital. It didn't have a lot of time. So the Bush administration did the best they could, but it basically constituted a bridge to Obama. And from really November, December of 08, President-elect Obama knew that he was going to have to do a much more fundamental restructuring of this industry than the Bush people were able to do in their limited amount of time.
A month after you started, your task force was calling for Rick Wagoner's resignation. I remember seeing an op-ed piece in the New York Times that defended Rick Wagoner's attempts to turn GM around, but you weren't convinced?
I remember that piece well. It was a truly moronic piece, a shocking piece that argued that the company would be deprived of Rick Wagoner's expertise. The fact was that in November, they had come to Washington and asked for $10 billion that would have been enough to get them through this crisis. In February, they submitted a viability plan that asked for more money, but it would have still not gotten them through the crisis. And by the time the dust settled, they needed $50 billion. So the point was that Rick Wagoner, as recently as February or March of 2009, didn't even know how much money he was going to need. No, I mean, our view was that in the corporate world, if you fail, you should be replaced.
And you described the culture of GM under that leadership as appalling. What was so appalling about the culture?
It was incredibly bureaucratic. It consisted of basically people who had been at GM all their careers and very little fresh blood, if any. The decision-making process was just incredibly protracted. The quality of the analysis and the detail of the analysis was way below, I think, normal Wall Street standards. And it just needed a big shakeup and a big airing out.
You write, GM, I'm quoting, GM could not tell you on any given day within $500 million how much cash they had, and the result was that they had to operate over $10 billion.
That's correct. They had extraordinarily antiquated—
They were just doing guesstimates?
Well, they had extraordinarily antiquated systems, and in fairness, it's a global company, and they had accounts all over the world, but they had no mechanism for bringing it all together, and— So the fact was that where they should have been able to operate with $5 or $6 billion of cash, they needed $10 billion of cash.
My guest is Stephen Ratner, who's written a book called Overhaul, an insider's account of the Obama administration's emergency rescue of the auto industry. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. The conventional wisdom at the time was that the automakers couldn't survive bankruptcy because it would just undermine their credibility. How were you able to manage the process so successfully and quickly then?
We had the same nervousness everybody else did. We didn't know whether people were going to buy cars from bankrupt auto companies. There's not a lot of good history around this. When you buy a car, you're establishing a 7-year relationship on average with that car. You want warranty protection. You want to be able to resell it at a good value. And we were all nervous about what would happen with a bankrupt company. But we didn't have a choice. There was simply no way to restructure these companies effectively outside of bankruptcy, and we had to take that chance.
You're right that you still have some concerns for the long-term survival of these companies because of their pension programs.
I don't think I said it quite that way. I think that they have pension obligations. I do think they're manageable. I have concerns about the global competitiveness of manufacturing and the fact that other countries do pay much lower wages than we do and achieve very high levels of productivity. I think these are long-term competitive issues that we need to address as a country. I don't think they threaten these companies particularly.
Well, German workers are paid quite well. How come they turn out cars that are really good and they also make a profit?
Well, first, I don't think their profit margins are quite the same as some of the other companies. Secondly—
Well, I'm mentioning them because they do have better paid workers than some countries in Asia.
When they manufacture in Germany. When they manufacture in this country, their plants are in the South for the most part, and they pay lower wages than the Detroit companies pay.
Mm-hmm. Could an effective restructuring have taken place without filing for bankruptcy, or was it the only way to deal with some of the more complicated aspects of the union contracts? Because I've heard that in those union contracts, some auto workers were being paid not to work.
That is correct. That's the so-called jobs bank, where workers received up to 90 or 95% of their pay even when they were laid off. But the UAW, in fairness to the UAW, they actually gave that up at the end of 08. It was sort of their version of the corporate jets. They knew it was something that was indefensible, and so they gave it up. But there were parts of the situation that required bankruptcy, not so much the UAW. We ended up negotiating a settlement with them or restructuring with them. But the bondholders in the case of GM and the banks in the case of Chrysler, we could not get them all to agree without putting it through bankruptcy.
In 2006, before the crisis, GM sales reached a record high of $206 billion, but they had a net loss of $2 billion. How's that possible?
Because GM had so much overhead, so many legacy costs, so many obligations that they could not make money unless over 17 million cars were sold in the U.S., which has only happened a couple of years. What this restructuring did was it took their break-even point down dramatically. So instead of needing 16 million cars sold to break even, they could break even now at a 10 or 11 million total national car sale rate. Right now, we're selling about 11.8 million cars a year in this country, very depressed from past levels, and GM has had two quarters of profits. So I think
$65 billion in car sales so far this year, but $2.2 billion in profits. Do people perceive them as making a better product? I mean, for years they knew that they were going to have to do something. They talked about doing electric cars, but the electric car that we've seen from Detroit is incredibly expensive. And now is it Mazda that's come up with the Leaf?
Nissan.
That seems to be more reasonably priced and answer all of the problems.
Well, I think you have to take that in a couple of pieces. First, with respect to the electric cars, there are different theories about what electric car will sell in the U.S. Nissan has made a bet on a lower-cost car that will be limited to simply electricity as its power source and therefore will have a limited range. GM believes that Americans have what's called range anxiety, that even if they're only going to drive 10 or 20 miles, they worry about running out of electricity. So the Chevy Volt, which they're coming out with very shortly, does have a gasoline backup motor.
How is that different than a hybrid then?
That's a great question. And it's different in the sense that, in theory, the electric motor will work all the time except when the battery runs low, which is different from a hybrid. But what's actually just come out in the last day or two, which was a secret until now, GM says because of patent concerns, is that, in fact, GM will use its gasoline source of power to sometimes power the car, even when there's also electricity still available to help with higher speeds and things like that. So it's sort of closer to a hybrid, but much more electricity focused than a hybrid.
My guest is Stephen Ratner, who's written Overhaul, an insider's account of the Obama administration's emergency rescue of the auto industry, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with Stephen Ratner. He's written a book about his experiences as the Obama administration's cars are, overhaul an insider's account of the Obama administration's emergency rescue of the auto industry. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. GM announced today that they're going to put more than 1,000 more electric plug-ins in stations throughout Michigan to help support the Chevy Volt. So I guess they're expecting most of their sales to be in Michigan.
I think it's probably easier for them to accomplish that there, but they certainly are hoping for nationwide sales.
Some critics of the auto team have said that the banks and other stakeholders didn't take enough of a hit in the crisis. Is that a fair criticism?
I write in the book that, in retrospect, if I had to do this again, I might have asked all the stakeholders to try to take a little bit more of a hit, as you call it. But I think the hit was fairly distributed as it went down. I think this is the government doing it, and so there are some things the government is simply not going to do. And we were, of course, incredibly pressed for time and had to do the best we could. On balance, I really do think it was a great outcome for the country, for the taxpayers, and for the stakeholders.
We cited the sales figures for this year for General Motors, $65 billion with a $2.2 billion profit. Ford, which turned down the bailout, has earned $4.7 billion of sales of $66.6 billion for the year. Not that much more in sales, but twice the profit. Why is Ford able to earn twice what GM does on roughly the same sales?
Because GM still has work to do to achieve the same level of profitability as Ford. One of the interesting things about this whole experience is that, of course, GM and Chrysler had to go through bankruptcy. Ford did not go through bankruptcy. Ford had the same UAW contract. They had the same competition from German and Japanese manufacturers. They had the same gasoline prices, the same credit crisis. So why didn't Ford go bankrupt? My view is because it had better management. It was more tightly managed, more profitably managed, and it was prepared for this. And so the fact is that Ford got through this crisis without bankruptcy. GM didn't, and the difference is management. And the difference in those profit margins you just cited means that GM has some work to do.
Well, Ford must have been tempted by the possibility of getting an infusion of cash, but they made the decision not to do it.
Well, they may have been tempted, but the consequences would have been wiping out all their shareholders, coming under the government's thumb with all kinds of other restrictions on how much they could pay their people and things like that. And they were very wise not to go through this process.
Chrysler, on the other hand, some people thought really wasn't worth the attempt. Is it true that at one point the vote within the Obama administration was 4-3 against saving Chrysler?
The vote in one meeting, in a very important meeting in Larry Summers' office, was 4-3 against before I voted and before Larry Summers voted. And he and I both voted to save it, which made the vote 5-4 to save it. But yes, there was a group of people in the administration who very thoughtfully, very analytically, very clearly felt that we would be better off if we let Chrysler go. But in the end, the president, who of course made the final decision, felt that we should save it because we felt we could save it.
GM wants to repay part of the $50 billion the federal government gave it to keep it afloat. Isn't the U.S. government GM's biggest shareholder with almost 61% of the automaker stock?
Yes.
Is that a good investment, do you think?
It was a necessary investment. It was something that we had to do in order to save the company. There was no other way to put our capital in and have a chance of getting it back. GM is scheduled to go public in the middle of November. Right now, the markets are quite strong, and all going well, GM will be able to go public at a very good valuation.
Although the stock right now is being rated junk.
Yes, but there are many companies whose debt is rated junk and still people can make a lot of money. I think GM is a very viable company, and I think when it goes public, I promise you or I predict for you, it will go public at a very significant valuation.
Is it too soon for GM to try to pay back the money to the government?
Well, right now it doesn't have a lot of spare cash. It has paid back all the government debt, which was, I think, about $5.5 billion from memory. The balance of that money is the 60% of equity that you described, and that will come from the government selling stock both in the IPO in November and then in subsequent offerings.
GM announced today that it was going to offer its 600,000 workers, retirees, and dealers a chance to buy stock in the company. Is that a good idea?
I think it's a great idea. I'm a firm believer in worker capitalism. I think having people have a stake in the enterprise they're working for makes them more focused. I think the only thing you have to be careful about, which has caused problems in the past, is that people should not have a disproportionate amount of their savings in any one company, including General Motors.
Because we've seen any number of people who own the stock in their own company lose everything when the company went belly up.
There have been some terrible examples of that, and there should be restrictions on that, and it shouldn't happen here.
Well, it's unlikely that GM's going to go belly up, is it?
I think it's extraordinarily unlikely, but the stocks go up and stocks go down. And even if it doesn't go belly up, there's no guarantee the stock will go up, and therefore people should have diversified investments.
Have you told some of those people who are running for office today that that's a possibility, the ones who want to privatize Social Security?
That stocks go up and stocks go down? Well, that's a different conversation we can have another day.
You write, the auto rescue succeeded in no small part because we didn't have to deal with Congress. Why didn't you have to deal with Congress?
Because fortunately we had access to TARP. Now, TARP is a program everybody loves to hate, $700 billion rescue program that President Bush put in place and President Obama endorsed. But it gave the government, it gave the Treasury the financial flexibility to attack all of these problems that we were beset by. If we had not had TARP, we would have had to go to Congress to appropriate all of the $82 billion that we put in these companies.
But you were overseeing $82 billion in taxpayer money that had been given to the automakers by Congress.
Well, it was the $82 billion was part of $700 billion that was part of a pool that Congress gave to the Treasury to allocate. If we had not had that pool, we would have had to go to Congress and ask for appropriations.
And what would have happened if you'd had to be overseen by Congress?
My firm belief is that they would have debated it and discussed it endlessly. And meanwhile, at least one of these companies would have run out of cash, closed their doors, and liquidated before Congress got its act together.
You have written very positive things about TARP in this book. Why isn't it being viewed more positively by the public?
I find that very perplexing. And part of why I wrote this book and part of what I like to tell people, and I just wrote an op-ed piece on this subject for the Financial Times, is that they should understand that TARP was a great thing. I think the reason people don't—
They call it the bailout, and if I want to win office this year, there's a good chance they say I'm against the bailout.
People are angry. People are hurting. We have 9.5% unemployment in this country. People's real wages after inflation have been going down for quite a while now. They're not happy. They're frustrated. I don't blame them. And so they lash out at whatever they can, and having politicians from both ends of the spectrum attacking TARP just puts more fuel on the fire and makes it harder for those of us who understand it and understand its importance to explain it to the country.
My guest is Stephen Ratner, who's written a book called Overhaul, an insider's account of the Obama administration's emergency rescue of the auto industry. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Used to write for the New York Times, so I'm assuming this was an easier book for you to write than some of the other insider accounts that others have written. This is not written with the help of.
I had some people helping with research and helping with editing. I wrote the book myself. It was not easy to write. I was a New York Times reporter a long time ago, and I never wrote a book. And even people who write books for a living, I suspect, would come on your show and say books are hard to write. So I struggled over it. I poured blood into it, but I'm very glad I did it.
And you were keeping notes at the time. Do you assume that you would write a book?
I didn't assume I was going to write a book, and I didn't keep a single note. And one of the things I learned in this book, for this book, I ended up doing 150 interviews because it took that much effort to reconstruct everything that happened.
You must have had fun writing the titles of some of the chapters. Dead Man's Curve is chapter one. Mr. Ratner Goes to Washington is the third chapter, followed by a quote from Rahm Emanuel about the UAW that the FCC won't allow me to repeat on the air. That's another chapter heading. And the Chief Executive Shuffle is the final one. You also include a six-page character list. It's almost like a Russian novel.
And I took some names out of that. There were a lot of people involved in this in one form or another, and we try to make it easy for the reader to follow.
An analyst wrote in to say that by comparison to what's happened with General Motors and Chrysler, employees who own BP stock lost 58% of their stock value.
I'm not sure what the point of that question is.
I guess some people have taken bigger hits than others. I mean, BP didn't get a bailout. So
they lost 58%, but GM employees, including all the senior management that had a lot of GM stock, lost 100% of what they had in GM stock because the company went bankrupt. BP has not gone bankrupt.
As the first insider account from the Obama administration, did you let him or others in the administration see your first draft?
No, I didn't. I wanted to write a book that was very positive about the administration because I believe in the president. I believe in what he's done, and I believed in this restructuring. But I also wanted it to be a book that people could read and feel that it was balanced and honest.
Are you still involved in this? I know that you have been working closely with some of the people from Michigan, Governor Jennifer Granholm, Detroit's Mayor David Bing, Senator Carl Levin. But Michigan's most recent unemployment number is 13.1%, much higher than the rest of the country at 9.6%.
Much higher, but no longer the highest unemployment rate in the country. That honor now belongs to Nevada, and it has come down a bit. When I was in the government, I believe it was over 15%. No, I'm a private citizen now. I still have an enormous interest in these companies and try to monitor their progress and try to explain to people like your listeners what's really going on with these companies. But no, I'm not. I don't have an official role.
You're back to working for Mayor Bloomberg.
I'm back to working for Mayor Bloomberg as well as helping to explain my book to people.
Even though the big three were saved, are the jobs ever going to come back, do you think?
I think you could see some increase in jobs, and indeed there has already been some modest increase in jobs at these Detroit companies. But we felt that the only way to save the patient was to do some amputation, and that's very painful, and it's unfortunately somewhat permanent. But we wanted to have these people, these companies alive, not dead, and that's what was required to get them there.
Some have linked healthcare to all the problems that the big three faced, in that so much of their money was committed to health plans, whereas in Canada, they can produce cars for a lot less, even if workers are paid the same, simply because there is a national health program.
The phrase Cadillac plans is a coincidence that it refers to a GM brand, but the fact is that the car companies had among the most generous health care plans in the country. It's slightly salacious, but one of the things the company said to me repeatedly was that they were the largest purchaser of Viagra in the world because of all their retirees who were allowed to have it for free. That has actually gone away as part of this new agreement. But
they're getting Cialis now.
I don't know that. That's above my pay grade. But the fact is that the GM workers were getting a level of health care that simply could not be afforded any longer.
You served on the Obama team for just a few months in 2009, February to July, and you're among a growing list of senior officials who are leaving the administration. Peter Orszag, Rahm Emanuel, Larry Summers, to name a few. Is there something of a trend here? Usually people stay a little longer, don't they?
I think you can differentiate among the cases. In my case, I had come to do a specific assignment. The job was done. I think with respect to some of the others, I always thought and believed that being in the government was a very tough, frustrating life. I had no idea how tough and how frustrating until I got there.
And that's without having to deal with Congress, you say.
In my case. But I saw these other people who did have to deal with Congress as they were battling the worst economic and financial crisis since the Depression. And it was as if everything was compressed and they were under this unbelievable amount of pressure. And they did I think they did a fantastic job. But I think there is a high burnout factor at the moment in serving in Washington.
Would you take another job if you were asked?
Probably not, almost certainly not, because, first of all, I had a wonderful chance to serve, and I feel as if the team and I made a real contribution. But I also, to the earlier discussion, saw the advantages of my situation. We were off in a corner. We had access to the TARP money. We could really do some very significant things simply by getting the president to sign off. And to have a job where you're constantly battling with Congress, I think it would be unbelievably frustrating.
I just had a vacation in Italy, and I was stunned by how small all the cars are. I mean, some of them are really small, although that's not the common one. But the big ones are smaller than our typical cars. And I wonder why Americans need such big cars. Doesn't it make it harder to find a parking space?
Well, I think outside of New York it may not be as big a challenge. But look, people have to understand as they make that comment that we have a different culture around the automobile than Europe does. People drive much longer distances in this country to get to work or to move around. And so they want the comfort of a larger car. And the other major factor is that we don't tax gasoline the way they do in Europe. Gasoline in Europe is, I think, around $7 a gallon, and here it's less than half of that. So in Europe, the price of gasoline forces people into smaller cars. We should be raising our gasoline taxes by a huge amount and using that money to help pay for some of the social programs that we're putting in place. But it is politically impossible to get the Congress to even think about raising the gasoline tax, even by a few cents.
Hmm. Well, but gas prices were certainly a contributing factor in the decline of sales. On the other hand, what you've written about here is one of the real successes of the early Obama administration, and yet nobody seems to be bragging about it.
I think the president has appropriately tried to brag about it. He went over the summer to a Ford plant, to a Chrysler plant, to a GM plant. But people just, as I said earlier, are just, I think, so frustrated, so economically stressed that it's very hard to convince them. I hope that when GM goes public, the president will get the credit he deserves.
Just one more thing. Do you have any thoughts about the buzz that Hillary Clinton might be President Obama's running mate in 2012?
I think people love to have these little items, but I think there is a zero probability of that. I would bet you a reasonable amount of money that Joe Biden will be the vice presidential nominee.
Stephen Ratner will not run for vice president. In fact, he says he doesn't want to do anything back in the federal government. But he's written a book called Overhaul, an insider's account of the Obama administration's emergency rescue of the auto industry, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.